Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, an original production from KJZZ. Every weekday, we bring you the latest news and culture from across the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I am Lauren Gilger. Coming up, zines are all over the valley today. We talked to the person who's been printing them for a decade and hitting the road across Arizona in 2025 and travel writer Roger Naylor's most memorable moments. But first, we know Arizona is hot. Too hot, oftentimes, for workers to safely spend long periods working outdoors or even indoors where there's not good air conditioning or airflow. But Arizona has no laws to protect workers in the heat. There are city ordinances, and the governor formed a task force that's working with the Arizona Division of Occupational Safety and Health, or OSHA, to come up with heat guidelines for employers. The results of that are expected by the end of the year. But there are no statewide laws. So our next guest this morning is pushing the governor to make them. Monica Sandschaefer is the Arizona State Director of Mi Familia on Acción, a Latino civic engagement organization. They are part of the Arizona Heat Standards Coalition, which delivered a petition to the governor recently calling for enforceable heat standards so that employers who don't follow them can be held accountable. The rub here will be requiring enforcement. I spoke with Sandschaefer more about it.
We are the state where we have the most extreme and dangerous heat season in the country, and we do not have a legal requirement that employers provide basic life-saving protections like water, shade, or rest. Right now, what we have is that employers can only be cited if workers are already at risk of death or serious harm. And as you can imagine, by then it's often too late. Mm-hmm. What we need is preventative standards that lay out very clearly for employers how they are expected to protect their employees, and for employees what they have a right to in order to continue to be healthy, safe, and productive on the job.
Okay, so that's kind of what is outlined in this letter to Governor Katie Hobbs, asking for the Arizona Department of Occupational Safety and Health, OSHA, to kind of create these enforceable, and I think that might be the key word, heat injury and prevention rules. Who would these impact most? What types of jobs, what types of workers?
Yeah. And you're absolutely right that the enforceable part is the key. We know that when we just ask folks to please do something, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. And you're always going to have high road employers that are going to take care of their employees. But what we want to do is set a floor so that all employers know what the standard is and are held accountable to that same standard. Right now, we have nearly 500,000 Arizonans that are working in heat-vulnerable jobs. We've all seen these folks, right? It's the landscapers, it's construction, it's roofers, it's farm workers. It's a lot of folks outside. The other thing that we've learned through this process is that it's also folks working inside, but without air conditioning or proper airflow. Latino families are the ones that are hit the hardest. So across the country, Latinos are three times more likely to die from heat on the job than non-Latinos. So airport workers, right? The airport workers that come in and clean the planes, they turn off air conditioning on the planes once they land, but the workers have to go in and clean in that heat. So it's even industries that you wouldn't necessarily immediately think of that need this kind of protection. And that's why a universal enforceable standard is what we need, so that every industry is thinking about this ahead of time so that they can protect their workers and they're held accountable to that standard.
The interesting thing to me there is that when you're outlining the kind of industries impacted, the workers impacted by heat mostly, like a lot of these jobs are going to be probably self-employed. Like, I mean, I wonder how you make it enforceable for a lot of these people who might, you know, not work for a big company, for example.
Yeah, there are a lot of contractors, and I think that does put folks sometimes at risk. However, what we see is that a lot of these are subcontractors who do have their own employees, right? Yeah. And so what we want to see is employers from every level, small employers to the largest employers, being held to the same standard, because no matter who you work for, you should have the legal right to water, shade, rest on the hottest days in the country.
So the governor did issue an executive order related to workers and heat earlier this year in May, kind of detailing what Arizona currently does and risk mitigation, future plans. Was that a not enough, or what would you like to see the governor do that's more?
That's a great question. So the task force, setting up this task force was a great first step. What's happening, what I've heard from my colleagues who are on the task force, is that a majority of the folks on the governor's task force want to see an enforceable standard for heat protections across all workplaces. However, that recommendation is not currently going to ADOSH. The recommendations or the guidelines for the employers are going, but not a plan for implementation or enforcement. So,
Okay.
what you want to see now is ADOSH couple those recommendations with a plan to actually hold folks to the standard, right? Otherwise, it's just words on paper.
Can this
You
come
know,
straight from the governor's office, or is this something that would need legislative action?
this does not need legislative action. It can come straight through the rulemaking process on the executive side. So that's what we're urging ADOSH to do, is to start the formal rulemaking process as soon as possible in 2026 so that we can get public comment. We know there's a lot of public support for this. And so the rule can be in place by the time the heat starts up again in a few short months. There's an urgency here to protect lives and to protect folks from heat-related injury and illness. And so we need things to move quickly.
There is a heat safety task force the governor put together, and it's set to deliver recommendations by the end of the year here. Have you spoken with them, worked with them? Like, I'm guessing they're probably looking at a lot of the same issues that you are.
That's right. And so we have some colleagues that are on the task force. And what they've told us is the majority of task force members do agree that ADOS should implement an enforceable heat standard with water, rest, shade, training, all of those kinds of things. What we're asking ADOSH now to do is to actually couple those recommendations with an implementation and enforcement plan. So they are looking at exactly the same thing. They're expressing the same amounts of concerns. Now the question is, what are we going to do about it?
Are there
We
federal
have.
standards already in place, Monica?
So there are federal standards that are being discussed, but they're in limbo right now. And really, when you think about it, extreme heat is an Arizona problem, right? This is a very place-based problem that we are very familiar with. The hottest summers on record, the four hottest summers on record have been within the last 5 years. We want to see an Arizona-specific standard to address this to protect Arizonans.
Where's the opposition? Like, employers might not want, to be able to be cited, fined, et cetera, for this.
That's right. Nobody likes to get a ticket. Nobody likes to get fined. But what we know is that that's what holds people accountable to the same standard, right? That's how you create a level playing field for all employers, is if everybody has the same standard and everybody is held accountable to it.
I'm guessing employers might say, you can trust us to do this. We want our workers to be healthy and not sick and do the job and be able to continue doing it, right?
Exactly. And we do think the majority of employers, of course, care about their employees and want to keep them safe, healthy, and productive. What we also know is that workplace heat standards, the enforcement of workplace heat standards works. So in California, for example, they implemented an outdoor heat standard. It reduced workplace heat-related deaths by 33%. So it's not that employers weren't already caring about their employees. It might be that they didn't simply understand the ramifications of the heat or what they needed to provide in order to prevent that, right? Right now, we have twice as many heat-related worker comp claims than some of the states around us, including Nevada, which has areas that got as hot as Phoenix does. And it's because we don't have a preventative standard that protects folks before something happens.
We'll leave it there. Monica Sand Schaefer with Mi Familia on Axion. Monica, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you so much.
We also reached out to the governor's office about their response to these efforts. They declined to come on the show. After certain kinds of injuries or wounds, think heart attacks, burns, and tendon tears, scar tissue can form to help the healing process. But that scar tissue can lead to fibrosis later on, which can be a problem in those patients. New research from the University of Arizona, though, is looking for ways to prevent that from happening. Dr. Kellen Chen is an associate professor in the Departments of Surgery and Biomedical Engineering at the U of A and runs a research lab focused on investigating tissue fibrosis and promoting regeneration. He's also the co-author of a study on this published in Nature Biomedical Engineering. Chen spoke with my co-host Mark Brody more about it, and they started with scar tissue and its role in healing.
Yes. So in humans, tissue injury can occur in a variety of different ways, but it almost always results in fibrosis and scar formation. So during the process of tissue healing, the body builds scar tissue through an overactive wound healing response. And this is in part mainly to try and plug up any injury that has occurred. But what happens is it leads to significantly impaired organ function. And so fibrosis causes a lot of morbidity and mortality and contributes to almost 45% of all deaths in the United States.
So it sounds like the key then would be to make sure that the scar tissue that is necessary for healing is there. But in a perfect world, maybe just enough to heal what needs to be healed and not so much that it causes problems later on.
Yes, exactly. Well said. So I think in response to an injury, the body has to do something. So right now, what it's mostly doing is creating too much scar tissue. And if we could tune that back, that would be great for promoting the right function. And then on the other end of it, as sort of regenerative biologists, we're interested in actually now maybe even convincing the body to regenerate and create new tissue that mimics exactly what your old tissue was like.
Well, and that sounds like what the research that you've been working on is doing. Is that right?
Yes, exactly.
So how exactly does that work?
Right. So currently there's, effective treatment strategies to prevent exuberant fibrosis have not been developed. So there's an urgent need to find ways to mitigate this condition or even shift it toward a regenerative phenotype. And so what we've been able to do is actually identify a specific immune cell type that circulates throughout your body, and it seems to act as one of the primary drivers of fibrosis across the body. And what we found basically in the study is that by specifically targeting those cells, you can then basically influence all the other cells in part of this healing process that are also dysfunctional, and convert them to become in a sort of less scarring or even pro-regenerative manner.
So does that mean that you're kind of turning that tissue back into the kind of tissue that used to be in wherever the injury happened?
So these cells respond to a process called mechanical signaling. So I guess before I get into all those details, in essence, whenever humans undergo an injury, they upregulate these mechanical stress profiles. And the reason that we upregulate those is because in order for us to have everyday motion and move, your tissues undergo that sort of normal stress and strain. So that's good for us to move normally. But when there's an injury, it actually can act in the opposite direction. So what we found basically is that by targeting those pathways in injured tissue, we're able to promote regeneration and have the tissue you go from that dysfunctional scar into the proper tissue that you need. So that can work if you wanted to, for example, inject some sort of therapy in the different organs. But what's really exciting about this study is that these cells naturally are circulating throughout your body. So instead of having to sort of target each organ individually and specifically, we can now target these cells, which are sort of the upstream drivers of this process, and have them beneficially affect the entire body all at once.
Are you able to take cells from different parts of the bodies and kind of send them to where the injury happened, where they might be needed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So after any of these injuries I had mentioned before, such as a heart attack, a tendon tear, or a burn injury, or even more, the body responds by, as you know, bleeding. So that blood is what delivers these cells throughout the body. So these immune cells are naturally circulating throughout your bloodstream. And we've already known for a long time that after injury, you need to have bleeding so that these immune cells come and sort of start this healing process. And what we've identified is that a certain subset of those cells that do go toward the injury are also very responsive to the mechanical environment, and that by targeting those, you're able to still have the normal process go on, but that you're able to reduce the fibrosis that occurs.
How do you target those cells and get them to sort of go where they need to go and do what you want them to do?
In the study, a lot of these studies were performed in animals. So in animals, what you're able to first do is you're able to genetically target those cells by creating a genetically modified mouse strain. So in those mice, we found that by specifically removing these cell types in the mouse, in the mouse's bloodstream, they exhibited much reduced fibrosis and even promotion of regeneration. So when we looked at the normal tissue architecture, it was much more similar to your normal tissue compared to a fibrotic scar, which has a lot of collagen, it's very thick and just feels very stiff. What we've also done in human cells, so we haven't obviously tested these cells in humans yet, but we've been able to isolate these cells out from humans and use an inhibitor of these pathways on the immune cells to downregulate this behavior, and found that that specifically then also promotes sort of reduction in fibrosis in a dish.
So then when you get to the point where this is applicable in patients, in human patients, would that be some kind of medication they take to sort of target these cells to go and do this sort of thing in these particular areas? Is there another way to make that happen?
There's two ways we envision this happening for humans. So one is that there's already a lot of immunotherapies out there. We're envisioning something potentially similar where you could take the patient's own blood and find these cells and then treat the cells with an inhibitor so that the cells do not become overactive, and then take these cells and give them back to the patient. And then this would reduce those fibrotic profiles. Another thing we can do is I mentioned these cells respond to mechanical signaling. Well, there are certain mechanical signaling proteins that are only on these immune cells, so they're not in any of the other cells. So if we gave the patient a treatment in their bloodstream that only targeted those cells, we'd have the same effect without accidentally targeting some of the other cells, your normal cells in your body.
Assuming that things continue going in a positive direction, how big of a dent do you think this could put in the problem of scar tissue causing all of these various problems in all of these various different parts of the bodies that people have?
Of course, as a scientist, it's always hard to know exactly, but as I mentioned, fibrosis does contribute to over 45% of all deaths in the United States, and we're all very familiar with heart attacks and burn wounds and tendon tears and also, liver failure. So this could potentially have very far-reaching impacts. We've already identified that these cells are specifically also upregulated in the fibrotic liver tissue, and so current efforts in our lab or to try to identify this in just a variety of other organ systems so that we can have evidence to test it all over.
All right. That is Kellen Chen, an associate professor in the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Tucson. Kellen, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look back at Arizona in 2025 through hikes and road trips.
So I really focused on mom-and-pop restaurants, mom-and-pop hotels. But it still had that same feel, that two-lane road, that pulling off at a place I didn't know anything about. Oh, that looks good. I like their sign. I'm going to pull in here and try here. And sometimes, man, you just have such a wonderful meal, or you come across a place with a great decor.
Longtime Arizona travel writer Roger Naylor walks through his favorite sites and stops of the year. But first, 10 years ago, there weren't too many people around town making zines. The little self-published booklets have a long history, but in the last decade here in the Valley, they've started popping up all over the place, from Zine Fest to zine libraries and print shops. There's a whole network of resources for creatives who want to publish a zine. And a whole lot of that has to do with our next guest. Carissa Lucille founded Wasted Ink Zine Distro in 2015, not too long after they made their own first zine. Now they're celebrating its 10th birthday. I spoke with them more about it.
So I first started making zines in my last semester of journalism college. It was 2014, and I felt like I needed another place to put all my writing that didn't really have a home. I wanted to be my own editor. I wanted to be my own magazine layout and designer. And I used all the things that I was learning in journalism college to kind of funnel into making my own zine. So the first one came out in 2014 and kind of had photography, writing, poetry about, different feminist ideas. And at that time, it felt very revolutionary for me.
Okay. So that was the first zine you ever made. You hid it all over town, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So initially, I looked into places where I could stock it on the shelf and set up a business arrangement, but I was still so new into the business world and the creative world that I just didn't have any of that set up. So I felt like, okay, well, even if someone finds this zine hidden between two books or on the bulletin board and throws it away, they still have to look at it.
They have to
One
look
of my
at
most proud moments was when someone came to me and said, "Hey, I picked up this feminist propaganda for you," and then handed me my own zine.
it. Does that
Very
kind
full
of,
circle.
right? I mean, like, does that kind of harken back to the history of zines as well? Like, that's kind of how they were distributed originally, too.
Yeah, I think so. I think zines have always been hidden in backs of stores or in coffee shops. You can find them taped to signs, and it's almost like an Easter egg hunt a lot of times. And wherever I go, I'm looking for zines and kind of trying to find where they're hidden in a city. Maybe blatantly hidden or just stocked on a shelf, in a comic shop or a bookstore.
Where is the kind of oddest place you've ever found a zine?
I think I got lucky on a bus one time, and sometimes I find them taped to street signs and things like that, which is just like that's like very guerrilla distribution.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But you started a less guerrilla distribution source for zines, right? Tell us about starting Wasted Ink and why.
Well, after distributing my zines all over the city for about a year and kind of popping up a little folding table at any event that would have me, from roller derby to little book fairs, art shows, anywhere that I could have a table, I set up when sold my zines. After doing that for a while, I said, well, why can't we have a place to all get together and have the zines on shelves and have a little creative corner where people can make them? It doesn't seem that outrageous of an idea.
Was it
And
hard to get it going, though?
to get it going felt a lot easier than maintaining, but we had a little tiny room. We took over a lease for a room that was maybe 100 square feet in a strip mall in Tempe. And the shelves were full of zines quite quickly, and we were representing about 30 makers, and that felt like a lot. That felt like an accomplishment back then, and it was just a big idea. I don't have a business degree. We didn't take out business loans or anything like that, but it was just an idea. It was like, okay, let's start something different.
Yeah.
Let's just try it,
Yeah.
and here we are 10 years later.
10 years later, right? I mean, so tell us about that. Like, why do you think it's lasted this long? Why do you think you've stuck with it this long?
I mean, I'm quite stubborn, and I want things to last in Phoenix. So many wonderful things will pop up and run into more natural roadblocks and close and fade out. And I really want wonderful things to last in Phoenix. And I think one of the benefits of this smaller business is that, it never had to pay anyone's salaries, including mine, and was more of a passion project. So it didn't need to grow monetarily, exponentially. It didn't need to be this huge money-making force. So it's always kind of been tucked in little bedroom size storefronts throughout Phoenix. It's had to be very flexible. There are periods of time where it had to be closed up in boxes, especially in more challenging years like 2020. But overall, I think being flexible, keeping it kind of smaller as it's grown, has been helpful in longevity.
So, I mean, how would you define a zine for someone who's never heard of this or doesn't really know this world? Like, would you call these art, journalism, literature, something in between?
I might call them all of those. A zine is it's a self-published, self-produced little booklet thingy. And it can contain any type of content, whether it's photography, poetry, journalism articles, recipes, comics, art, prose. It can be anything under the sun, and also a mashup of all types of different mediums. It can be by one person or a collective of people that have decided to publish together. Some of them are black and white, some are in color. They come in different sizes. There's really a huge variety under the zine umbrella, which is very exciting. And also, I just want to read all of them, and that's just impossible.
Yeah, I bet. I bet. So, I mean, you mentioned how kind of brand new the zine scene, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, was in Phoenix when you started this, like just kind of figuring out how to do it on your own and hiding them places. It's 10 years in. I mean, it sounds like this has become quite a big world in the Valley.
I think so. And, that's not to say there wasn't anything zine related in Phoenix early on, but I had a real hard time finding it. And I didn't really have anyone who took me under their wing and said, this is how you do your layout. Is this who you should print with? This is how you assemble them. This is how you distribute them. This is how you price them. I didn't really have that. And so our main goal with Wasted Ink and the Phoenix Zine Fest and Paper Jam is to really break down the barriers that people experience when it comes to making a zine, so that they can more quickly create and distribute and be a part of a larger community.
Yeah. All right. Well, congratulations on 10 years. That is Carissa Lucille, owner of Wasted Ink Zine Distro, joining us. Carissa, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it too.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. As we head into the end of 2025 here, we're taking a look back at some of our favorite conversations from the year. And one of the most memorable for me was with a woman who doesn't often talk about herself. Lisa Setti is the longtime owner of the Lisa Setti Gallery, one of the best in the Valley for decades. She's done interviews over the years about her shows and the artists she represents, but this year, on the gallery's 40th anniversary, I got the chance to talk to her about her own path in the arts. Her first gallery was in Tempe, and for many years she's been in an Al Beadle-designed building in central Phoenix. But she first really made her mark on the art world here as a pioneer of the Scottsdale gallery scene. Though it's known for its cowboy oil paintings and desert landscapes, that's not the kind of work that gets Setti excited. She champions artists who have something to say, whether it be political or someone like William Wegman, who's famous for his artistic portraits of his own Weimaraner dogs. I stopped by her gallery in March to get a peek at the 40th anniversary show and spoke with her more about her legacy and her approach to art. She came to Arizona as an ASU student in 1978 because she was interested in learning from a particular professor, a British photo historian named Bill Jay. At the time, she told me she thought she was going to be an artist herself.
And then as soon as I graduated, I realized that I was more interested in what other people had to say than what I had to say because of a fairly traditional, normal upbringing. And I just didn't think I was that interesting. So I was living in a house with six roommates, so seven of us total. It was an old house that belonged to the first Tempe printer, I think. And we had no furniture, so there was, nothing in the living room. And I thought, well, this is such a nice empty space with all this wall space. I should have an exhibition of my fellow artists. And so that must have been probably 1978 or 1979. Maybe that was my first gallery or idea of a gallery. But I knew as soon as I graduated that I didn't really want to be an artist, but I needed to be close to art and in the arts.
Okay, so you have your first quote-unquote gallery show in your house, right? What did that feel like? Do you remember sort of getting a thrill out of being the curator, being the person to put this together?
That's a great question, great way to look at it. Of course, I didn't realize what I was doing at the time, but I must have loved it because I think I remember I liked organizing it. I liked the outcome. I mean, there weren't any sales or anything, but I liked how things looked. And I liked that I was, trying to elevate other people's work.
So you begin there and then you take it into a, you know, the most successful gallery career in Phoenix, right? Like, how did you kind of make the leap from, you know, a house show into opening your own gallery?
Well, I started as soon as I graduated working with my ex-husband, Joe Segura, and we opened a print publishing company. And then that sort of easily sort of morphed into a gallery space for me in a little part of the front part of the shop. And I realized that prints, you know, fine art prints really weren't, that wasn't my thing. And I wanted to show, you know, originals. So that was probably back in 1981. I've been an employer since 1981. I was in my like early 20s as an employer, which is really silly.
But there must have been, I wonder about this, because so much of what you do, right, is relationships with artists and then relationships with buyers. So it's a lot about people. How did you start to shape your language and your thinking about not just talking to people who might want to buy a piece of art, but talking to artists about how they sell it?
I like people and I like connecting people. And I like that artists think in a way that most people don't, and that there are many people who are responsive to that type of thought. And so I think my joy was in putting them together.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions about sense of place, right? Like, what you do is located here, right, physically. But I also know that you've worked with artists over the years that are from here. You brought up artists from here. And you've worked with a lot of artists that kind of deal with that idea, like whether it's an immigration kind of sensibility or if it's somebody who wants to talk about the environment, sustainability, these sorts of issues that really ring true in Arizona. How do you view the artists you choose, the people you work with, and the place that you're in?
I'm going to go back to the show we had before this one, which took place October, and it was timed for the election. And it was called Grand Canyon from Dreams to Memory. And we decided to focus on immigration because I thought that was an important issue as it related to the election, impending election. And we chose seven artists from six different countries. And I wanted their perspective on something that I personally sort of took for granted, the Grand Canyon. I mean, I had the privilege of being born in the United States. I went to the canyon once. I looked over. It was magnificent. And I came home and didn't really think that much about it again. And so that brought in artists from many different countries, but some of whom are here in Arizona, too. The West has always attracted artists for many different reasons, the light, the landscape. And so we do work with a pretty great group of, you know, artists that happen to be based in Arizona.
I mean, I wonder that because so much of what you think of when you think of the art scene, and especially in Old Town Scottsdale there, is Western art, right? Which is not what you do. I wonder about the kind of going with trends or understanding where the headwinds are taking you and then sort of saying, no, I'm going to show this instead because this is the artist I think is good.
Well, we don't follow trends. We never have because I'm just not that hip. And I'm kind of in my own little world. And so I'm focusing on what interests me at the time. And maybe that has to do with what's happening in the world politically, you know, socially. But I'll also say that my idea of a Western artist is probably different than other people's idea of a Western artist. Like, my idea of a Western artist could be James Turrell, who's working with, you know, the extinct volcano, the crater up in northern Arizona. Or, for instance, Mark Klett, who's in our, both of whom are in our anniversary show. And, you know, Mark's looking at it from a geological perspective and time, you know, time in the West maybe moves a little slower. You know, so I feel like we do show some Western artists, but they're not, it's not a traditional Western art that most people, you know, might think of.
I want to ask you about the, I guess, for lack of a better phrase, the art scene in Arizona, in Phoenix, in the Valley, because you've been a part of it for so long and an important part of it for so long. How do you view us in the national or international art world? Do people still think you're crazy to try to sell fine art in Arizona?
Yes.
As simple as that.
Yes. I mean, there's a big art scene here. But again, it's, I don't want to say stigmatized, but it's sort of put into a niche of, maybe it's the advertising that's done around a lot of the art, and especially in Scottsdale, and it's more traditional, and it seems like they're not really up to date with what's really happening here in the art scene. And we don't have a lot of art criticism here that then reaches to a broader audience. you know, outside of the state. So that makes it difficult to break the stereotype.
Let me ask you about the idea of abstract versus, you know, something that's more realistic or has a purpose in a very, in a more obvious way, I guess. I wonder this about art because so much of art is subjective, right? And your job is to be sort of objective about this subjective thing and say, this is what is good. You're the arbiter of that, right? How do you know? How do you, like, do you ever think you've had misses?
Sure, I've probably had lots of misses. I mean, I guess the way that I would describe it is that I'm looking for an artist whose their reason for creating it is sincere, and they're compelled to make it. They have to make it. They have to get a message out. And the message is often personal, but then that personal message opens up to being something universal. And I'm also looking like to see, is the medium that you're working in, does it make sense for what your message is, you know, for what you're trying to get across? I'm looking for something that I've never seen anything like this before. I need a new medium or a new message that where they coalesce and they teach me something in a way that, you know, that I just respond to at a gut level. So the gut level probably comes first, and then all the intellectual stuff happens after that. But I'm interested in people's stories. Like, what compelled you to make this work? What was so important about your background or your experience that you had to create something for yourself, but then also to be brave enough to take out into the world?
Yeah. Is that how you view your role as the person, kind of the behind the scenes person who's finding and choosing and displaying this work?
I think maybe I was born in the 1860s or something, like, you know, as an explorer and, you know, and to tread lightly on, you know, new land, but to discover things.
Lisa Setti, thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Lauren. It was so nice to meet you and talk with you. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. As we wrap up 2025, let's take a moment to live vicariously through a man who is never without a good trail to hike. Roger Naylor is a longtime Arizona travel writer, and he sat down in our studios with me recently to talk about his year in hiking and road tripping and what he's looking forward to next year.
A lot of hiking to begin with, a lot of driving, a lot of road trips. The Route 66 Centennial is coming up in 2026, so I was making a lot of trips there as I was finishing up a book project. So it was nice, those old-fashioned road trips, you know,
yeah.
Just driving with the windows down, pulling off, stopping for a burger here and there, and enjoying, you know, brings back a lot of vivid memories. But I had, you know, a few adventures as well. I did something I'd been wanting to do for a couple of years. I went up to Lake Mead National Recreation Area in the Lake Mojave, that section of it at Willow Beach, and kayaked to Emerald Cave, which
Ooh.
Is a very popular Instagram kind of famous spot because it's a good photograph. So I knew, you know, I kind of knew what to expect. I knew it wouldn't be secluded. I knew it's a small little cave and stuff. And I'm always a little nervous on water because I'm more of a hiker. I don't swim. But it was flat water. It was easy. Very accessible and beautiful. And what I didn't know at that time, you know, I booked on a Monday. And Monday and Tuesday, that section of the river, the 30 miles south from Hoover Dam, are no motorized boat.
Oh.
So it was very peaceful. So it was just a whole bunch of kayakers out kind of paddling up the river and then paddling back. We waited our turn to go into Emerald Cave, and you kind of have to back in and, you know, snap your little photos. And if you get there at the right time of day, the reason it's called Emerald Cave is because the sun comes in and it just turns the water this brilliant green.
My goodness,
and,
yeah.
You know, all around. So it was really, really lovely.
A standout moment in your year for sure. Yeah,
yeah. I enjoyed it. So
and what about along Route 66? Like, you spent a lot of the year writing this book that just came out on Route 66. The Centennial's coming up, as you said. Are there moments you had in reporting that or writing it or driving along there that stand out for you?
Well, I always do. With the book that I wrote, Arizona Route 66 Road Trip, I really wanted to focus on not just the history of the road, but what's available right now. I wanted people to have a chance at an old-fashioned road trip, not an interstate road trip, not a place where you just stop at the first fast food place you come to and stuff. So I really focused on mom-and-pop restaurants, mom-and-pop hotels. It still had that same feel, that two-lane road, that pulling off at a place I didn't know anything about. Oh, that looks good. I like their sign. I'm going to pull in here and try here. And sometimes, man, you just have such a wonderful meal, or you come across a place with a great decor. I stopped in a Kingman at this little place called Grandpa's Kitchen. And how can you avoid that? And
it's
I mean, it's packed with places. The food is really good, and it's big portions, and it's all bustling. But one table gets up to leave, and the guy goes, "All right, see you tomorrow." And then another table gets up and leaves and goes, "Okay, see you next week." And so it's like, not only are there regulars, but the staff knows their schedule. They're so regular. And I think it's nice to know those kind of places still exist. We forget about that sometimes. I stopped out at Kingman Airport Cafe and had one of the best burgers I'd had in ages. Just, you know, and the walls are surrounded with all this old memorabilia, because Kingman has an incredible aviation history. During World War II, it was turned into this Army airfield where they trained B-29 gunners. People
wow,
like
yeah.
Charles Bronson, Clayton Moore trained there and stuff. And so there's all this wonderful memorabilia and photos, and I'm just eating this burger that's just out of this world. I mean, this is what road trips are all about, these little tiny moments that you hold on to and you still
discovering
remember.
Something you probably wouldn't have otherwise.
Exactly.
I got to ask about the Cleeter Yacht Club, because this is such an odd place and such a cool one. You went there this year.
I did. I wanted to write a story for the Arizona Republic about it. I wanted to head up to Crown King up in the mountains there. But one of the stops along the way, because you take off on this dirt road, and a few miles up, Crown King, you're climbing an old railroad track, so it gets a little dicey. Sometimes four-wheel drive is needed. But the first few miles, still out in the open desert, out in the middle of nowhere, is the Cleeter Yacht Club with just this – it's just an old watering hole, the porch, but – the backyard is just full of old boats and surfboards and, you know, all this, you know, very beachy. It's like a tiki bar almost kind of feel to it.
But dry as a bone,
it
right?
Is. If Jimmy Buffett had grown up in Phoenix, this is where he would go drink. You just feel like it. And so Buddy and I went out and, you know, we headed up to Crown King, had our burger and did that. And on the way down, we stopped at the Cleeter Yacht Club and go in for a cold beverage. And out in the middle of nowhere with a few regulars. I think there were more dogs than there were customers. There were about three just kind of wandering around, just big sweethearts, and sitting out on a surfboard having a cold beer in the desert looking at the cactus. And I think, I'm in Arizona.
Sounds
maybe
about
this
right.
This is perfect.
One of the big things that happened this year in your world, right, was just the big changes and cuts that came to public lands. I mean, national parks, national monuments being, first of all, attempts to scale back, but just massive budget cuts, staffing cuts, et cetera. What do you think about that? Like, have you heard from folks in the parks and how they're kind of handling all this?
I have, and it's, you know, it's very unfortunate. I had just written my book, Arizona National Parks and Monuments. It came out the end of last year, and I was starting to do promotions and presentations and talks, and that's when the hiring freeze hit and the cuts came, and all of a sudden they couldn't even promote a lot of the presentation stuff. Then staff cut back. So, yeah, I've been in touch with a lot of them and, you know, managers and, you know, behind the scenes. They're holding on as best they can, but it is really a struggle, especially some of the smaller parks. That's where they were housed. That's, you know, where they lived, out in the middle of nowhere, you know. And all of a sudden, not only were they without a job, but they were without a home and, you know, sent packing. And I had a couple of parks managers tell me that if they lost one more person, they were going to have to close. I mean, they were just hanging on by a thread. So it was very difficult. And then the government shutdown came at a really awful time. On top of that, there's going to be damage. There's going to be degradation. The national parks, the state parks, all this, all the public lands, this is what makes Arizona so special, is that, you know, we have these green spaces. We have open country around us at every level. Arizona is very good about setting land aside, and if we're starting to lose any of that, it affects communities, affects way of life.
Yeah. So some concerns from 2025, I'm sure, lingering into 2026. But let's end on a positive note. What are you looking forward to next year as we roll into the new year here?
Well, obviously, the Route 66 Centennial is going to be a very big deal in Arizona, especially because we're the state that saved Route 66. We're the one – this is where the preservation movement began, where the tide of history turned. So a lot of – It's just going to be a great opportunity to get out and explore again. I'm kind of overdue. There's a couple of state parks I haven't been for a while, and Lyman Lake over in the White Mountains and Oracle State Park down north of Tucson I want to get to. And, you know, there's always places, you know, that there was a time in Oracle Park, I still remember, where I was hiking this trail, and it's a wildlife refuge too, and I stopped on this trail, and this deer was just a few feet away from me and stopped, and we just stared at each other for the longest time. And I mean, I've seen a million deer on the trail and stuff, but we just had this quiet little moment, and I kind of reached for my camera, and then it bolted. I'm going, I knew better. I'm no tourist. That was just one of those trail moments that I got to share that only I get to experience. So, you know, those little tiny moments, they just add up. They're important, and that's why we have these kind of open lands, these kind of parks there for us to enjoy, to experience.
I'm sure many more in your future as the year kicks off here. All right. Roger Naylor, longtime Arizona travel writer, joining us. Roger, thanks so much. Appreciate it, as always.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Here's to some trail moments for you all in 2026. Thanks for listening to the show today. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram at KJZZ The Show and sign up for our weekly newsletter, Radioheads, at theshow.kjzz.org. For Mark Brody and Sam Dingman, I'm Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayana Hamilton. The show was created by John Hoban, and our executive producer is Amy Silverman.